Diversity. Well, hello everyone, and happy new year. I think this is the first video of 2026, and well, what an event do we have to talk about today. I'm joined by Todd Lewis, Praise of Folly, who wanted to talk about this as well. Welcome.
Well, thanks for having me back. Good to be here.
And he's actually going to join me on a few videos this week because we've got quite a few things we want to get through. But if you missed the news, I don't know how you could have. In the dead of night, American special forces went in and abducted the leader of Venezuela and his wife, Nicolas Maduro and Mrs. Maduro, I forget her name now, and basically kidnapped him and took him to New York, where he's going to stand trial for drug trafficking. Is that right?
I think so.
And then Trump came out and said, well, we're going to run Venezuela now until a new government can be found. We're just going to run it. And then, I mean, last I saw, obviously this story is developing, but the interim president of Venezuela, who's some woman, I forget her name, has come out defiant and said, actually, Maduro's still the president. We don't accept this. So, I mean, I don't know, like, as things stand, I don't think things have changed. You've got America, Trump, saying that America is now formally going to run Venezuela. And we've got the existing Venezuelan government saying, actually, we're still here. So, anyway, we can get into all of that. Another large aspect of the story, Todd, I want to get into has been the frankly quite shocking reaction of the so-called dissident right, online right, whatever you want to call it, which, we can get into it. But I would say in terms of days I've seen on Twitter, probably the single worst day I've ever seen on Twitter for just trash, awful takes. But we'll get into all of those as well. Before we get going, I have to remind people, this book, Foundations of Shakespeare, look at this volume. Look at the quality of it. They've really put a lot of effort into this. They call it a prestige edition. And it's got, as I've mentioned, lots of lovely color maps and color illustrations and things. This has is due out. It's available on pre-order. And if you own the course, if you own Foundations of Shakespeare from me, all you have to do is send them a receipt and they'll give you 50% off. So it's a pretty good time to get courses right now because promo code SHORJAN gets you 25% off all courses for all of January. I do it every year. So I'm going to play the ad, and when we come back, we're going to break down this Venezuela issue, what it means, take a review of some of the takes that we've seen, and much more.
Sure. Sure, 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 sure. And so, sure.
Sure, Jan.
Can you command a comma like Joseph Conrad?
Sure, sure, sure,
sure, sure, sure, and sure, Jan.
Are you magnificent in your mastery of marginalism like Murray Rothbard?
Sure.
Sure, Jan.
Are you legendary in your logical leveling of lamentable loquacity?
Sure.
Sure, Jan.
Come on down to the January sale of the Academic Agency. Promo code SHORJAN for 25% off. All this January, I got more courses than the Queen had horses.
Sure, Jan.
I got better rates than Andrew Tate's ad mates.
Sure, Jan.
I got better deals than Lizzo's had meals.
Sure.
Sure, Jan.
And so, sure, 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 and so, sure.
All right, and we're going to be talking about Curtis Yarvin and NRX stuff tomorrow, so that's going to be fun. But first, you can tell that ad's a couple of years old just by some of the references and me talking to Curtis and so on. But anyway, let's get back to Venezuela. First of all, Todd, I mean, this is a pretty extraordinary thing, isn't it? The abduction of a world leader.
Yeah. The closest thing we can point to would be the arrest of the president of Panama back in 1989. Now, that was a much smaller country, and there was actually a firefight between whichever special forces were deployed and the Panamanian bodyguard of the president. This was just sort of like a ship in the night kind of thing. When this started breaking yesterday, I was a lot of this just felt off, like something is off here. And one of the things that was obviously off is the Venezuelan military did nothing. They just stood by and watched. Now, compare that to Manuel Noriega in Panama. They fought back. No, they lost, but they didn't just stand by and, you know, let the U.S. arrest Noriega. You could think of Iran and the Iranian hostage crisis, right? They sent in Delta Force, and the Iranians don't back down. You can also see the same in Somalia back in 93. So this tells me that they probably bought off the right people in the Venezuelan government to just not do anything.
There was another odd detail as well, which is that Maduro had just met with the Chinese.
Yeah.
Videos of people, like hours beforehand, he just met with the Chinese government. So the fact that he went from that to then being abducted without the army doing anything. I mean, I don't know about you, but everything Trump does, everything now, domestic, foreign, wars, has... Do you ever see that film years ago starring Robert De Niro? And was it Dustin Hoffman? Was it Wag the Dog? Do you remember that?
Yeah, I do.
Yeah, now Wag the Dog was... If you didn't see that film, it was a film about a war that literally didn't take place, and they staged all the bits of it. But because it was on TV and because everybody reported on it, it kind of like became reality, even though that, you know, there were heroes, and there's a scene where they bring a guy back in a coffin, but the coffin's empty and all this sort of stuff. So Wag the Dog is literally a truly phony war. And a lot of the things that Trump has done, I mean, I thought that the bombing of Iran was a bit like this. It's all a little bit Punch and Judy, where you've got like weird back channels of like the Iranians talking to the, you know, tipping off, like the Qataris were tipped off and the Iranians knew what was coming and nothing was really there. But it's a big theatrical event, right? And Trump gets to say, well, it's a great big military operation, but it's got this kind of weird Wag the Dog element. I mean, another strange thing, Todd, is that a huge amount of the clips that have been circulating, the most viewed one was by Alex Jones, but lots of other clips I've seen are fake. They're old, or they're from Chile, they relate to things that happened in 2018 or last year or things like that. So the footage, the actual footage of the people in the street or of celebrations and so on, has also not been real. This is a bit also confusing to me because it compounds with all these other factors. But we have seen images of Maduro in New York now. So he is there.
Yeah, well, he's there. So because when we first heard about the capture, I thought, well, we haven't seen Maduro yet. So this is like early last morning. And I'm like, did Maduro really get captured? Now, you know, he's allegedly now on trial in New York now. So we have more pictures, and it's not just a he said, she said kind of thing. But I do think that the most likely explanation is that at least some people within the Venezuelan government were either bought off or threatened off. It's just really the kind of action is not unpredictable. They did this in Iran in 79, Venezuela, Panama in 89. But it's... You just have nobody fight back. I mean, you saw videos of the attack on Caracas, and it was pretty tepid. There weren't that many missile strikes. It was like, this is all really weird. It's like something...
No anti-air.
No.
Russian involvement.
And so one thing...
No Chinese involvement.
No. One thing that this shows us, though, is that... Well, it does two things. Like you said, it gives Trump a sort of victory he can point to. But the other thing that it does is... It creates a unrealistic expectation of what U.S. special forces can do. So if you have cooperation from inside the regime, which is probably what happened, yeah, you can do that. But try doing that in North Korea. You're not going to have cooperation with inside the regime. So a lot of Americans, I believe, are going to draw the wrong lessons from this. The lesson being that the Americans could just go in and do whatever they want, when in fact, in all likelihood, they had inside support. This could also be framed within a broader pattern. So after Vietnam, the U.S. loses a protracted conflict. What do? Well, the U.S. starts wars in Nicaragua, Panama, and Grenada. It beat up on some Latin American countries to restore respect in the U.S. military. The U.S. loses the GWAT. Now what? They're losing in Ukraine. Now what? You know, a little victory in Latin America works. So this is part of a pattern where the United States loses a protracted conflict and then beats up on some Latin American countries to look tough to restore faith in the U.S. armed forces. But it you said it's kind of a Punch and Judy show. It's kind of insincere.
Well, it's still not clear. I mean, one of the huge takes doing the rounds, I mean, one of the dominant ones was you can just do things, right? That was one I saw. And it's almost like, you know, in a video game where you select the options, it's almost like people, you know, on the old take sphere pulled up a Rolodex of like four or five different options. And option number one there was you can just do things, okay? Or isn't it cool? That was another kind of variation on the same theme. But it's not obvious that this is actually like done and dusted. Like the idea you can just do things is, this is like the chess theory of global politics. You take the leader and then you gain the country. Is that how it works?
Well,
wouldn't politics be really simple if you just kidnap the leader and now you gain all of the country and all of its resources? I mean, didn't Venezuela have a deep state? Didn't they have a government? Didn't they have, like, government still there? Who are these people? Like, the defense minister came out and said, we're not having this. So, I mean, we don't know what's going to happen, but this strikes me as weird. It reminds me a little bit, Todd, of the Syria situation, where it seemed like the Assad regime was actually thin. Like, people weren't being paid. There was no, like, it dissolved. Like, as soon as Assad went to Moscow, the entire regime collapsed almost overnight. And now Syria's got a new government, this jihadi bloke. Do you remember him?
Yeah.
He's still there. So we've seen one similar scenario where a regime just, like, is not as strong as it looks from the outside or whatever. In my, like, as a someone versed in elite theory and so on, I always think, well, there's a robust deep state. There are entrenched elements. There's a bureaucracy. There are clients of the regime. There are people. There's a regime. It wouldn't be that easy, for example, in a country like Iran, right? Even if you kidnapped the Ayatollah and took him, there are, you know, the IRGC owns like 30% of the land. You're not just going to be able to get rid of those people overnight. They're entrenched. But in Venezuela, apparently not.
Well,
or maybe we don't know.
We don't know. So part of the response from certain elements on X and the internet is that, you know, woohoo, America's won this great campaign. Well, what happens next? I mean, it's only a few days in. Yes, Maduro was captured. But what does that mean for the long term stability of Venezuela? For example, there's no U.S. forces occupying the country, right? It was just a snatch and grab. Is there a larger full-scale invasion still in the offing? Some people speculate that. That's what I think a lot of us expect Trump to do at some point. And you could view this as maybe the first phase. But also living in the tension, right? This interim president of Venezuela says they don't accept this. The U.S. isn't going to comply. So what happens after they try Maduro and there's this like diplomatic limbo where who's actually the president of Venezuela? Who's actually the legitimate ruler of Venezuela? And that creates all kinds of mess. Now, maybe that was the point. I don't know, right? But that creates a lot of ambiguity as well. It's different than the post-Iraq invasion ambiguity, where you had all these insurgents running around. It's more of an international diplomatic ambiguity.
Yeah, it's funny you mentioned Iraq, because one of the other images doing the rounds has been George Bush, George W. Bush Jr., with the mission accomplished sign behind him. Do you remember that? Mission accomplished. I mean, that doesn't look so hot now. So that's been another, I mean, you know, a lot of people who are old enough to remember, you know, the first lot of neocons are thinking like, oh my God, how can everybody be falling for this again? But why don't we move on then to some of the reaction that we've seen, not all of which, in my view, seems natural or organic. Like, certainly it wasn't my reaction, and a lot of people did have what I thought would be the natural reaction, but a lot of people had very odd takes, in my opinion. We can move through from the I mean, there's the American right and there's the British right, who are worse, in my view. But, you know, I asked people on Twitter to estimate, and somewhere between 65 to 75% of kind of influencer takes were pro this action, right? Including from people you wouldn't necessarily expect to be pro this action. And this strikes me as particularly strange at a time where there is heightened awareness of Zionist influence on the US government and heightened awareness of the fact that Benjamin Netanyahu had just been to visit Trump, like literally a couple of days ago, and seemed to give him direct orders. And there's been all sorts of clips doing the rounds from Fox and elsewhere of people explicitly saying, well, this is good because it's good for Israel. Venezuela, Maduro, was pro-Iran. Explicitly anti-Zionist. And Chavez, if you remember him, was accused of being anti-Semitic, quote unquote, lots of times. And I noticed that as part of the action, they bombed Chavez. They bombed his dead body, which strikes me as strategically useless, but symbolically, it has symbolic value. And again, you know, I asked this question and thousands of chuds basically just said, well, it was funny. Oh, you know, nothing better than a dead commie and all of this sort of stuff. But to me, it was like this sort of petty, vengeful behavior. It seems like a different type of a MO. So to me, there's a lot of arrows pointing in that direction. And I just find it odd for people who have already come to the conclusion that their government is in hock to a foreign power to then cheer on the actions of that exact government. The way I phrased it before, Todd, is that it's not your empire. It's Ben Shapiro's empire, right? It's Ben Shapiro's empire, not yours. So he's ecstatic and happy, right? And that's fine. But for you to be ecstatic and happy is weak, cuckolded, and honestly reminds me a little bit of Reek from Game of Thrones. So, I mean, that's really what I'd say about those Americans who've been loudly celebrating this, okay? And then on the British side, it's been even worse, Todd, because the dominant take in Britain has been, I mean, okay, you could say it's a joke, it's satire or something, but a lot of people, and I would say, I mean, there was Faraz from Lotus Eaters, Carl, Dan from Lotus Eaters, Ed Dutton, I'm pretty sure I saw Survive the Jive say this, this has been one of the takes doing the rounds, you know, maybe I've got some of those names wrong, which is that, okay, now it's Keir Starmer's turn, i.e., wouldn't it be great if Trump invaded Britain to take out our socialist dictator, Keir Starmer? Right now, part of it is ha-ha, like a have-I-got-news-for-you joke. But, you know, since being challenged on it, a lot of them are doubling down on that take, which to me is even worse. It's like, well, okay, it's Ben Shapiro's empire, not yours. And now you're begging for Ben Shapiro to come and invade and formally occupy your country? Weird. Me and you are not the same if you have that as a genuine thought. But anyway, Todd, what are your thoughts on this really quite bizarre social media activity?
Well, yeah, and you're right. A lot of voices that you wouldn't expect, you know, especially in the American right, who pointed the finger at Zionism in Israel, are now just like, who do you think is going to replace Maduro if the U.S. gets their way? A Zionist shill, just like in Mexico. It's like, well, who do you think is? It's not the win you think it is, right? It's not the win you think it is, because even if you think that Maduro is a socialist and a communist, who is he going to be replaced by? It's not going to be replaced by one of you guys, right? And so that's what I see when I see that is there's like two groups of people who are doing this. There are older online right thought leaders who are getting successful in the new Trump administration, or at least believe they will one day. And that creates what we might call the upper crust. And they're like, it's getting good now. You know, we're just going to go along with this. You know, now we put the woke away, we put all this away. And then there's going to be what you already mentioned, the sort of like chud takes, where they're just like free helicopter rides for communists, right? The sort of like Hoppe, Yarvin, you know, libertarian alt-right pipeline, right? And so with all this, you sort of have this, one of the things with like Moldbug, not so much Hoppe deals more with economics, but with Moldbug, there's this sort of like fetishizing of force, right? Because Hoppe's a libertarian, he's an anarchist, so he's against all that. Whereas Moldbug flips it on its head. And it's like, well, we just need to use force, which is funny because that's the Marxist idea. You know, Mao said that violence is a creative force and power grows out of the barrel of a gun, right? They're actually leaning into a way of thinking that's more articulated by the communists, not the libertarians that Moldbug was getting these ideas from, at least in some of his ideas, right? And so this also gets wrapped up in the broader narrative that the empire is just under bad management. Because this all comes out of the libertarian, a lot of it comes out of the libertarian movement. And they would have said, well, the empire is just bad because it's the state, blah, 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 you know, whatever. And Moldbug's like, no, the empire is good. We just need better management. And I think that I've come to conclude he's probably a psyop of some kind, because he's been wildly successful in ways that benefit a certain group of people that were not readily apparent he would be that successful in 2007.
He was on the BBC the other day as well. It's been noted. It's on wow. BBC News. Oh. Mm. Well, we can talk more about your, I mean, we should break down a little bit, but what do you mean by the empire being under better management? And I mean, what I take him to mean by that is rather than Democrats, Mandani, let's say, right? Instead, you've got, the people who are in power now.
Yeah, the
hardcore Zionist Republicans, essentially. Okay, yeah. So you've gone from one bad group, Kamala Harris type Democrat, to, in my view, an equally bad group, but in his view, his own people, essentially, hardcore red Zionist Republicans. And it seems like, you know, a lot of these other takes are downstream from that. You know, the view that, you know, Britain would be better off under a US Trump-led US occupation as opposed to being under Keir Starmer. And it's basically the same idea, right? Well, okay, we know that they have certain issues, but can't be any worse, right? Can't be any worse. I debate that, to be honest. I really do debate that. I mean, if we even think about the consequences of these actions, a lot of people have noted that every other time regime change has been tried, it has led to refugee crisis and migrant crisis. Do you see an influx of Venezuelans? Or do you think Venezuelans will go back to Venezuela? The many Venezuelans who are currently living in America, will they go back there? Or is America going to end up with more Venezuelans?
Well, this kind of gets to your earlier point about Venezuela still having a continuity of government. There is no U.S. occupation force in Venezuela currently. And it was just a snatch and grab in the night. So, I mean, technically, all the old political power structures are still there. It's not like Venezuela has been, the state has been destroyed, like, say, it was in Iraq. The Iraqi state was destroyed after the U.S. invasion in 2003. So I think part of answering that question depends on, does the U.S. just sit and watch this weird diplomatic ambiguity happen, or does it continue putting pressure and invade directly? because you could argue by removing the head of state, you're weakening the state for an invasion. We don't know yet.
Is there any, I mean, the justifications for this have been, you know, that it's drug related. Another justification has been that it's all to do with oil. And another justification has been that it's about combating communism or something like this. Why has this actually been done, Todd?
Well, I mean, I think oil. I mean, that's why we went into Iraq. That's why the U.S. went into Iraq. You know, what, Venezuela has the second largest proven oil reserve. They were shipping lots of that oil to China. Now, of course, you know, you're going to say the Monroe Doctrine with, you know, Russian, Chinese, and Iranian assets in the area. But, I mean, you know, Cuba's been there for a while. Nicaragua's been there for a while. Nothing happened. I mean, Cuba initially with the Bay of Pigs, right? But that was a long time ago. So it's 61. So recently, we haven't really seen a whole lot. But I think another reason is the U.S. has to deliver some sort of tangible geopolitical win because it lost the GWA and it's losing Ukraine. They got to do something because that's just the pattern that was established after the Vietnam War.
It has been suggested that there's a kind of a swap deal that has been done, which may explain how smoothly this has gone, i.e. they're going to let the Russians have Ukraine or those bits of the Donbass. They're going to let the Chinese have Taiwan in exchange. America gets Venezuela. I mean, that's been one of the takes doing the rounds. I'm a little bit skeptical of that, Todd. For one, a lot of the Trump thinking around Ukraine has been for the Europeans to do this division of labor plan that Brian Beletic talks about. And certainly the European governments have not stopped being bellicose about Russia. And when push comes to shove, the American government has not withdrawn support for Ukraine whatsoever, despite the theater of Zelensky and all of that. You know, that has continued. And Taiwan, I'm led to believe, has got a lot of, you know, superconductor processing, manufacturing and things like that. They're just going to give that to the Chinese. I just don't buy it.
So well, I don't believe that. No, I don't really think there's a sort of like inside deal where they're like, it's not a new Ribbentrop-Molotov pact where they're carving up spheres of influence. I actually think that this could sour relations with Russia even more than already. So in 2022, when Russia invaded Ukraine, they stated on RT that because of unilateral action against Serbia in 1999 and then Iraq in 2003, both of which were in clear violation of diplomatic law that the United States was claiming to enforce in the UN, that all of that eventually forced Russia to act in the way that they did. Well, this is just that, again, these sort of unilateral direct actions that do not have diplomatic support. So I think it'll likely worsen said relations with Russia and China for the reasons that such relations were worsened when previous actions of a similar nature were taken.
Just before we sign off on this one, Todd, I want to talk a little bit about the Monroe Doctrine, okay? My buddy, Dickie Spencer, I still talk to, right? And I did a show with him on this very topic. Kind of tentatively supported this. He kind of did it, you know, in a slightly more sophisticated manner than the Chuds, as you'd imagine. But he did it citing the Monroe Doctrine. And I also, possibly under the influence of Spencer, I noticed that Nick Fuentes kind of had one toe in of supporting this. He was, again, tentative. But again, under this notion of the Monroe Doctrine. So I didn't really know much about the Monroe Doctrine. It's not something that we're taught here, really. I mean, I didn't do international relations at university or anything like that. So I spent about an hour reading around it. And my honest conclusion from reading around is that the Monroe Doctrine is basically just like whatever. It's just whatever, whoever the US government is, does what they want, and then they justify it by citing the Monroe Doctrine. So I guess my first question, because it changes over time, and every government comes out, well, now it's FDR, and now he's citing it, and now it's George Bush, and he's citing it, and now people are doing it to justify this. First of all, what is the Monroe Doctrine in a nutshell, is this an example of it?
Okay, yeah, well, so the Monroe Doctrine, when it's stated originally, was that the United States would not accept any new imperial powers in the New World. So by this point, I think it was 1825, the Spanish had already left, the French had already left. The British weren't going anywhere, but it wasn't really directed at them. The Portuguese still had a colony in Brazil, but then there were future colonists, later Germany and the later of the 19th century, colonial powers that they were concerned about. So this is very clear. This is about the United States giving its, defining its space in the New World, saying that no new imperial states. So it was directed at European powers that were attempting to recolonize the New World. A good practical demonstration would be that after the U.S. Civil War, I believe it was President Andrew Johnson, threatened to invade Mexico because the French at that point had invaded Mexico, a sovereign state, because the U.S. was busy with the Civil War. It began as a part of a debt collection effort with the British, but then later the French tried to take over. And so we have the French trying to start a new empire by absorbing a sovereign state. That is a textbook application of the Monroe Doctrine, because the United States is saying we're not going to have a new imperial power in the New World. This is regime change. Right. This is taking a sovereign state, which is not an imperial power, and then taking its leadership. Now, the Monroe Doctrine being invoked to do regime change, rather than what I mentioned with Mexico, to kick out or prevent entry of an imperial power, I believe begins in the early 20th century with the interventions like in Haiti in 1915, the Banana Republics in the 1920s. And now it's being used as regime change. But why? Because now we have the corporate capture of America. We've talked about this before. From 1895 to 1915, we have the Great Rapprochement with England. We have the Federal Reserve Bank being formed. And now they're redefining what the Monroe Doctrine is. It isn't about protecting America's interests or sovereign states from invasion by European powers who are imperialist. It's regime change to allow these economic actors to get resources in Latin America that they otherwise couldn't get.
And is there any truth to the idea that Venezuela had an independent central bank or a nationally owned central bank? Because this has been another one of the takes doing the rounds on the more conspiratorial end of the internet, that actually what this is about is, establishing a quote-unquote Rothschild central bank in Venezuela. Any truth to any of that in your view?
I don't know anything about that. I can't say one way or the other.
But presumably if they were socialist, their bank would not be connected, as intricately to the Fed and the Bank of England and that whole network. And if they are going to come into the Western sphere, they then be plugged in to all of that. Just to steel man Spencer a little bit here, I'm sure he would argue that this is an example of a European or old world power, led by Russia, perhaps with some Iranian and Chinese money as well, propping up this Maduro regime, that the Maduro regime in itself is not really sovereign. It's a proxy of Russian Chinese power in the region, and therefore America/NATO would be justified in expelling it. How would you respond to that?
I mean, let's look at how these both Maduro and then Chavez before him. Now I know there's disputes over the fairness of the elections, but these were elected political leaders. So if you have a political leader who invites people in to help build up his military, provide internal security, and do all this kind of training, that's not the same as a old world power invading directly. So France invading Mexico in the 1860s, that is classic Monroe Doctrine violation, because you have somebody invading a sovereign state. Whereas when a sovereign state invites members of the security apparatus of other sovereign states into their own country, countries do that all the time. I don't really think that that's a terribly analogous situation.
So the reason I'm sticking on this is because I think I just understand where Spencer may be coming from in particular, because he would say, well, okay, but if that's the case, Todd, then surely all Zelensky did, Zelensky, the democratically elected leader of Ukraine, simply invited foreign powers to come and help him and his military. So how is that a threat to Russia? How is America doing this any different from Russia doing that? And my feeling with Spencer is that in order to be consistent, he is, you know, he is basically saying, well, you know, if you're going to take the line, like the John Mearsheimer line, that Russia can do whatever it wants in its sphere of influence. So if it doesn't like the sorts of things that Ukraine were doing, it's going to intervene. Then surely this is in the same sort of ballpark. How do you respond to that?
Well, I would say that the level and scale of the threat isn't really commensurate. There's no way that Russia or China could successfully supply Venezuela in a protracted conflict. Not like, say, NATO just mobilizing assets and troops right on the border of Ukraine and with Russia. Now, we could also add Cuba into this for the Cuban Missile Crisis. If some foreign country is going to put ICBMs to hit you 90 miles away, that's a lot more analogous to the Ukraine situation, because, you know, while it's conventional weapons in Ukraine, it's, you know, Moscow's not that far from the border. Having NATO troops that close to Moscow would be a very real threat. So if we use Cold War logic, back in the 60s, the U.S. took missiles out of Turkey in return for Russia taking missiles out of Cuba, because both were seen as close because it reduces the flight time and the more deadly that way. Whereas Maduro was a nuisance. He didn't really threaten anyone. I suppose one thing I should say is Maduro had been saber-rattling about invading Guyana before all of this. And it is kind of interesting that no one's brought this up yet. He threatened to invade Guyana and take like 80% of its territory east of some boundary that he disputed. Now, that could have also been just, you know, machismo for home consumption. That's also possible.
Well, one last thing before we leave this topic. I've seen a number of maps doing the rounds of Latin America or South America with the Israel flag over certain nations. So, for example, since Milei came into Argentina, he is extremely obviously a Zionist. Okay. And in fact, an Israel firster, you might say. Brazil went the other way. Bolsonaro was a Zionist. He is now in jail, and Lula is an anti-Zionist. Okay. But lots of Latin America has been flipped to being pro-Zionist recently. And I guess my question is, why is it important? I mean, Latin America is a long way away from Israel. Why is it important for Israel to have pro-Zionist Latin America? It seems strange.
I mean, in a sense, we already do know that Venezuela is the second largest Peruvian oil reserves, so I think that's part of it. But then also this whole global Zionist apparatus that's embedded itself in European governments and U.S. governments, it's sort of like a chessboard where, well, you don't want, say, anti-Zionist forces like, you know, Islamists or China, I guess. I don't know. China's kind of not necessarily anti-Zionist, but it's not controlled. And you don't want those people gaining influence and clout over these countries, because that just means you don't. It's like leaving gains on the table.
Right. Okay. Interesting. Very interesting indeed. How can I put this? It's kind of perplexing as to, you know, because all the focus before that was on Iran, right? And maybe it's going to go back to Iran. But it's kind of strange to get this kind of like, we're going to shift focus now all the way back to over here, and yet somehow it's connected to what's going on over there. One of the things that people have suggested is that it may, you know, silver recently hit like its peak ever price, ever, right? Some people have suggested that this action that we're seeing here is connected in some way to averting a crisis by these silver prices, because silver is used in electronic manufacturing and, you know, for conductors and things like this. Elon Musk was flapping about it. Elon Musk has been very vocal in his support of this. So do you see any angle here where, you know, China kind of had leverage over America due to this silver thing? Well, now with Venezuelan oil, which the Chinese were reliant on, they can hit back on this to get the Chinese to back down on the silver or something like this. I don't know.
I've not heard that theory yet, and I don't really see an obvious connection for how that would work.
All right. Well, there it is. Yeah, I mean, it's kind of a weird one, this, but I do think one of the angles that we didn't touch on, but that I immediately thought, is that to me, it felt like this is the moment where my immediate thought was MAGA has not made it into 2026. Whatever the old MAGA was seems well and truly dead at this point. The heart and soul of it has gone, and now we're being served up regurgitated George W. Bush neocon with some chuds going along with it. I say some because the people who haven't been going along with it are vocal. And also, Twitter X is so botted now. It's so infiltrated with call center Indians and bots, and, you know, that it's hard to say how much of it is real. You know, Devin Stack said he noticed that, you know, a couple of little keywords and he was getting swarmed. A couple of my posts have been swarmed, right? But you can kind of tell, like, you know, all right, now I've got 1,000 replies and half of them are from December 2025 join dates with two followers each and things like that. Kind of look, it kind of feels botted, you know what I mean? So, yeah, my last question is MAGA done, Todd? Is this it as a kind of genuine organic movement that has core support of lots of people who don't usually follow politics? Has it been successfully re-GOPized?
Well, yeah, I think what we are seeing is that I think MAGA started to fragment seriously when Trump didn't release the Epstein files, and that was an easy thing for Trump to do. It's like, this is why they wanted you to be president. And then also, of course, he's now starting all these wars, which, as you said, some still oppose, but a lot disturbingly do. And so I think the question is, MAGA was probably more of a mood than a movement, in the sense that it represented a feeling in the country rather than a real movement. And the feeling is changing. The feeling is breaking up. And so that's creating noise and dissonance within the establishment MAGA.
Interesting. I mean, I will say that it's a strange moment, because a lot of the people who you may have followed or listened to 2-3 years ago, or even a year ago, increasingly feel more like they're just shills now. But there's still a very sizable and strong anti-Zionist voice online. And I'm not just talking about the Candy Sowins Tucker. I'm saying there are new, I guess you'd say, influencers who've come up in a slightly different moment. And things that appear obvious to them, or that you'd assume would appear obvious to everyone, don't appear obvious to the old guard, who, if anything, are dwindling into conservatives. They're just dwindling into the next generation of Rush Limbaugh. You know what I mean?
Well, yeah. And then I think a lot of these dissidents were only dissident in the sense that they didn't like the current situation, first under political correctness, you know, that starts like in the 90s, and then under the woke, rather than a serious critic of the system itself. Now, those two groups were shoved together because they had a common enemy and, you know, the political correctness woke track. But now that that seems to have been derailed, those who can, you know, we can get back to the old ways now. We can do things the way we used to do again. And, you know, they're more successful now. They're more financially successful. And so there was that old conservative argument that, you know, once somebody starts being successful in this country, they trend towards conservatism because they don't want to pay as much taxes. Right now, now they are, quote unquote, stakeholders. At least they think they are. Right. And so because of that, there's a natural pull that happens, right? You might actually be a radical and then you become less radical over time. This phenomenon I see it on the left as well. Think of like the yippies, right? And then you also have people who were just, they weren't serious people, but it wasn't obvious at the time that they weren't serious. It's becoming more obvious now because you can hide that for a while, but like over time it becomes harder if you are an unserious person.
Yeah, I will say, I mean, not to be, I mean, I have a reputation for being a bit of a negative Nancy, Todd, right? I will say that not everybody has disappointed me. I've been disappointed by majority of people. Some people who disappointed me previously, right, let's say 6 months ago, 9 months ago, they were still being maggotarded and not seeing, right, they weren't seeing reality as it was. A lot of people in that sort of boat, 6-7 months down the line, now seem to be out of their funk. And these are Americans now I'm talking about. They seem to have got over and seen MAGA for what it is. And they're finally now have used this moment to kind of come out and, you know, say the right sort of thing. So it's not all, but it's not all, I guess why it gives me hope is that people can kind of go back into error and then come out of error, you know, once they've seen that it's a dead end or whatever. So, yeah, maybe some people can be unserious for a period and then go back to being serious.
That's a possibility, too. I think a lot of this is just that the right, because in the United States, it tends to take an oppositional stance to the liberal hegemony, is of necessity going to be more of a grab bag because it's like, well, we all are united by what we don't like in that particular institution rather than having a clearly defined, this is what we stand for. And so you realize, oh, hey, that wasn't my friend after all. We just didn't like that one guy over there. Now that guy's gone, we don't like each other. So that starts to bubble to the surface once these tensions get resolved and released.
I know one guy who gave a speech 5 years ago. 5 years ago now, Todd. I said, look, the one thing that's going to unite everyone is that you're against the regime. If you make that your bottom line, you can't ever go wrong. People didn't want that. They prefer their dividing lines because truly they weren't against the regime. It was just like those people who do film reviews and are just disappointed at the quality of the propaganda. You know, there's a channel like Critical Drinker, you know, oh, I don't like these woke movies because the messaging's too on the nose. I prefer my propaganda to be a little bit more sophisticated. And ultimately, there are those people who are just like that with politics. They just want their politics served with a little bit more pandering. And that's enough for them. They weren't against the regime in totalis.
Yeah, no.
And there it is. All right. Well, this Venezuela story, maybe some new things will emerge soon. Todd will be back. We're going to talk about Curtis Yarvin tomorrow. I'm looking forward to that. But like I said, pick up Foundations of Shakespeare. Promo code SHOREJAN gets you 25% off all courses. And I'll see you next time.
See ya.
If you like this video, be sure to like and subscribe. You can join the channel for thousands of hours of past shows in the archive and hundreds of videos. If you have any questions, you can leave a super chat or a super thanks, and I'll be sure to pick it up during my weekly office hours, which run every Tuesday afternoon.
I also provide courses at the academic agency, which I encourage people to buy. Thousands of students now have taken the Trivium to improve their skills in writing, logic, and rhetoric. Just three of many courses available. Buy it now. But most importantly of all, friends, get out.